There we go. So, could you start by saying your name and your current job title?
So I'm Edward O'Neill. I'm a postdoc researcher at the University of Oxford within the Department of Oncology.
That's great. Thanks very much. So first of all, just tell me a little bit about yourself, starting from when you first got interested in science. So just take me through the main stages in your career so far.
So I guess going backwards, this might be an interesting way to do it. So I came to Oxford in 2017. And then a couple months later, had a first baby. But prior to that, I was doing my my PhD at the University of Sydney in chemistry, making MRI contrast agents. And then prior to that, I was working making new glues, so making new forms of construction adhesives, and then doing undergraduate chemistry and regulating chemicals as well on the side for the government. And then prior to that, you know, high school, I enjoyed science. In many ways, it's sort of a thing that sort of I fell into. It's something that I've always enjoyed problem solving and trying to solve things. And science has always been something that is just a nice way to express that. And I've always enjoyed, the prospect of maybe doing medicine, but I actually ended up really enjoying science, where you can sort of reflect and to think about what is there and, more importantly, what is not known. And that really excites me. So when I was doing my degree in science, I was quite conflicted because I wanted to do everything. I settled on chemistry, but I was also actually doing immunology, so a lot of it. So I was actually a bit of a crossroads, a bit of doing into immunology and virology and things, and I was quite fascinated by that. In fact, I was quite interested in doing a project that was going to lead on to actually making vaccines, actually. So it was synthesizing a new form of nanoparticle that would be allow you to put stuff on to make it as a vaccine. Which, you know, that group is still working on vaccines. In fact, I think they're starting to new more next generation vaccines still, actually, for COVID. So that sort of seed of interest actually was quite interesting, how it sort of threaded through and up to the vaccine trial, where yeah. I got to have some interests. I already had a bit of knowledge. I knew quite a bit about all this stuff. I wasn't working in vaccines or anything. I'm working on radiation oncology using radionuclide therapy. So using radioactive isotopes and that are injected into people to then treat cancers for neurocrine at the time, but now prostate cancer. So quite a bit different to vaccines. But it is a field that will have, you know, lasting implications on the rest of oncology with the new oncology vaccines and things. So it is a fascinating area with vaccines.
So we should just say that until you came to Oxford, you were in Australia. Is that right? So when you say government, you mean the Australian government.
The Australian government. Sorry. Yeah. I'm not sure if it really comes across too much anymore, but my Australian accent. So I lived in Australia for most of my life. My wife and I are Australian from Sydney. Did my undergraduate at University of Sydney, then my PhD there. So then I came to the University of Oxford, had a bit of time in University of Turin in Italy before coming here, but otherwise so I'm Australian, and I
And so, as you say, yes, you developed an interest in chemistry, but the way you followed your chemistry, it's brought you back to biomedical science through the work on radioisotopes and using that to treat cancer.
Yeah, so I've always been quite fascinated by sort of translational, you know, creating a product. It's very similar to making glue. So you're creating something identified in the market and getting something, you know, that's of use to people. But there's something much more valuable, I guess, in terms of creating a new medicine. So hopefully getting something that you are creating in terms of an idea to be done in the clinic, that's quite a fascinating area. And so, you know, it's quite interesting being a part of a clinical trial to actually see what it's like on that receiving end, if that was in many ways.
Well, we'll get to that. We haven't quite got to that yet. But so just to delve a little bit further into your current problem. The idea is to deliver these chemicals directly to tumors, to target them at tumors, so they deliver their radioactivity in a very focused way. Is that correct?
Yes, very almost. It's sort of, there's a form of radiation that you deliver seeds of radiation that will be directly to tumors. That's called brachytherapy. But what mine is sort of an injected therapy that the chemical targets the type of receptors on the tumor, so things that are on the surface of the tumor, that then causes them to be taken up by the tumor. It ionizes or irradiates and damages the tumor from within, and then causes the tumor hopefully to not grow anymore or to maybe regress and be cleared. But it's a form of focused, sort of targeted form of radiation. And my type of research in particular is trying to find ways to understand what is actually going on in the biology with that. It's not actually quite straightforward. And there's new opportunities, therefore, to combine it with other chemotherapies that, because we don't really know what the biology is happening with it, there might be new opportunities to exploit with additional drugs. And then you have this lovely targeted therapy that hopefully uses the understanding with biology to then use other drugs to then have an even greater effect than just the radiation alone or the chemotherapy alone.
Great. That all sounds very good. So let's now arrive at the end of 2019, beginning of 2020. How can you remember where you were when you first heard that there was some kind of respiratory illness spreading in China, and how soon you realized it was going to be quite serious for the world at large?
Well, I don't think it, I mean, in many ways, it's sort of very similar timing right now. You're sort of after the Christmas sort of period, everyone's sort of a haze looking forward to the future, and you're not really thinking of like what is going to affect us like that. It's going to be, there's always some new thing like Ebola and stuff, but then it goes away. And then I think there's a bit of a tolerance to that, that we sort of feel as if these big things don't, they feel very removed. And in many ways, I feel as if a lot of the British press doesn't really like to talk about too much about these sort of things over in China, a bit of Asia and stuff, or how they're, and it was definitely seen how they compared themselves to other countries. It didn't compare themselves to Southeast Asia countries or anything. And so there was a bit of a narrow view. It was only when it went to Italy. And when it was Italy, that was a big focus. And there was a big sort of thing of, oh, you've got to make sure it's all contained and stuff there. But that was actually of interest to me because I actually had a conference that was organized in Verona, which geographically is between the two epicenters of those Northern Italy outbreaks. And my conference was going to be early April. So it was going to be the first week of April. And I was really looking forward to it. I was looking forward to going to them. Then I was going to go to Mount Poliet in France. And it was actually going to be like a holiday because at that point, I didn't actually have much of a holiday for quite a while. And it was going to be like this lovely chance of sort of be refreshed. Because, you know, things going on in our lives that we wanted to actually have a break and actually replenish ourselves and stuff. We were actually hoping it was a nice break. so it became dawning on us that this was not likely to be going ahead. Even though there was no cases reported around that area at the time, it seemed oddly inevitable. And I remember people saying that, oh, it'll just blow over, it'll be fine. You know, you'll be able to go and stuff. But obviously I wasn't able to go. That conference only just got postponed again and again and again. So only recently I went to it. And I was, I was quite excited about that prospect because I was going to be invited to give a big lecture for it, which was, as it turned out, to be really quite a pivotal moment in my career right recently in terms of being an opportunity to sort of make my sort of, I guess, have my voice out there in my field. So it was kind of, it was quite a bit of a change of reference in terms of seeing that this wasn't going to go ahead. And I remember, with the lockdown and things and not being able to go back to work, I remember just like, I better go to work, grab what I can, and set myself up at home. That included getting my big screen from work, that I put into my son's trailer. I just hooked it up into there and basically snuck out as much as I could all my stuff that I needed to work from home.
When you say your son's trailer, you mean a trailer for a bicycle?
A bicycle, yeah, because I didn't have a car at the time. It just fit, basically. It was one of those huge ones, which was very convenient for working from home. So,
because the university essentially told everyone to go home a week ahead of the actual national lockdown, I think it was, wasn't it?
It was probably middle
of March, yeah.
Yeah, and we work in animal research, so we had to sort of stop all studies. It was quite a change of reference. I mean, I kind of quite used to having to just be reacting with whatever things out of your control in my research, like because I deal with radioisotopes that sometimes get cancelled shipments or there's less of it, there's some issue or logistics. I'm used to just having to be a bit flexible and just making do what we can. So that was my mindset, just making do what we can. Have no idea how long it was. My wife was freaking out. That was going to be like, oh, it's going to be for 3 weeks. How am I going to deal with 3 weeks? It's just like, she just reflects and like, oh, wow, we were just so naive. Like, you just cannot have a frame of reference to be stuck around the house for so long. But I remember it just that sort of the feeling of like, we don't know if we've had it or who has it, and that uncertainty. And the testing just was completely non-existent. And so it was just kind of a blind thing where we feel as if we thought we had we knew of people who got sick with it. And yeah, it was quite, like I may have been slightly exposed to someone who may have, but I was only there briefly because I was running late. So maybe that was a fortunate thing. I was running late to them, that thing, but then that sort of spread through that person. The person was a GP, and so, you know, understandably was exposed to people who are unwell. And so it was kind of, yeah, I mean, in many ways, it was kind of nice how simple life was in that respect. It was nice just to be, this is what we're doing. I remember like a lot of things of just, how are we going to have enough milk? You know, just planning out how much milk we have, introducing powdered milk to our lives and things, and just the lack of availability of online shopping. But those early days was just, I think it's hard to remember and reflect on it, but I think it was stressful. But what I remember with fondness was of the unity and the sense that everyone was in the same boat together.
And was there anything you could get on with work-related stuff? I mean, you say you brought your screen home. Did you have work you could do that only involved the computer?
Yes. So I realized very early on in that I had a habit of basically always doing another experiment as always. And I never really invested enough time to actually reflect and reanalyze data. And so it was a good opportunity to actually look at data and reframe things. In many ways, I probably, without that opportunity, wouldn't have actually discovered or some interesting findings. Having that sort of pause, which in many ways I've tried to adopt and tried to maintain, and I think that's sort of a nice result of homeworking for scientists, lab scientists, to actually be away, removed, allows you to actually reflect on what you already have in terms of your data, to actually reflect on things a bit more than just kind of the next thing. And because it's kind of, at times you don't have to use your brain, you can just do things that are kind of muscle memory. It's just nice to be sometimes just in the movement and the flow of things. It's nice to do lab work, but it's actually important to sort of reflect on what you do.
And so how did you come to hear about the vaccine trial?
Through a work email. I saw it, and within, you know, I don't know how, it was with that day I replied and signed up. It was something that I talked about with my wife, and I think we sort of discussed it, and I did the final sort of signing up for it that night after my son went to bed. And
And what were the considerations that went through your mind when you were deciding to sign
up? So now that I can talk about it, I feel like I can be a bit more honest about it, because at the time when you have those interviews afterwards, I started to realize how important for politicians are to not just be waffling on and tell the whole story. You have to be very grabbing in terms of what is the critical piece of information and the critical communication. So I can now talk a bit more expanding about what my thought processes were. But, early interviews, I'll just talk about how, trusting the vaccine and just trusting the evidence and the science, whatever. But in terms of short sort of sound grabs, but in all honesty, I looked at the papers. Am I still there?
I am still there. Keep going. My screen has somehow disappeared, but it's because I touched my. I've got one of these very sensitive mice, and yeah, it. Sure. You carry on talking. I'm sorry.
I'll keep going.
Still here.
That's okay.
We're still recording. I will try and get back to you.
That's all right.
It's moved the image onto a different desktop. I just have to find the desktop.
Okay.
But don't worry, I am still here and you're still there.
Okay. So we had a link to the email. They just wanted to get, volunteers quickly, and using the networks of using the university sort of medical science division, maybe they just send it out to everybody. Clicked on the website, had a look at it, and in reference to that, they had all the papers beforehand. And in many ways, it sounds like it's this miracle of science, lucky sort of result, or this like amazing result and things. But it was just, in many things in science, when you pair it back, it's many years of work, many years of boring work that lead to it. And it was just the fortunate reality that they already had a functioning vaccine that was effective against MERS. That was the thing that really struck me, was that because they already have, and I know from immunology, from my undergraduate and stuff, is that most of the concern when it comes to a new vaccine will be the acute response, the adjuvant, if it's too stimulating or not stimulating, all the things. But because they already have done that, and they've basically had the whole scaffold,
Chadox one.
They've already tried it in people. Yeah. I just thought it
chimpanzee
was like
adenoma.
They already tried it. I think it was something like 200 people before me. This is the sort of regular scale that they were used to. This is the normal scale at Oxford University would be doing, and then the whole thing will be spread out over a decade or something. But this is all obviously squashed into a matter of a year or less than a year. Not that they didn't do any of the science properly or anything. It was just, yeah. So I was very confident with the fact that there wouldn't be any immediate sort of, I wouldn't drop dead sort of thing.
Because of your background, you were able to absorb a lot of quite technical information in order to get that kind of confidence. I'm just wondering, I think that they did kind of skew towards approaching healthcare workers and people within the university to volunteer. I wonder whether that was partly because they wanted to have a fairly well-informed cohort.
It's very possible. I mean, they would want healthcare workers, they're more likely to be exposed, to be honest. And yeah. I think it's quite a fascinating thing if you were to look at it, this study, the first cohort. They were probably the worst cohort to study because they're the most conscientious people and they're most likely to avoid high-risk scenarios unless they had to with their workforce. So they're probably the worst candidates because they were not less likely to be infected and they probably had less infection than subsequent cohorts. So it's kind of an irony of that. That's probably best for that in terms of being aware, but they're not really good as test subjects to actually test the efficacy of it. So I was definitely aware of that it was, a pretty reputable vaccine. I could understand what its structure was in terms of the design, that it's effectively just a tiny little bit on top of it. It's not very much that different. So it seemed like fairly low risk, because compared to what we were seeing with COVID, was that it was just, we had no idea who were the susceptible people. We had no idea who was high risk. We had no idea in terms of it. What we did know is it was killing lots of people, and it was obviously horrible and bad. And so it was kind of a, as I, you know, is my sound bites, as I was saying before, my sound bite was basically saying, we have, what we know of COVID is really bad. What we know of the vaccine is acceptable risk, but what we know already, the known knowns, are really bad. And so I'd always wanted to redirect people to the fear of actually COVID itself rather than the vaccine, which for something we had more control and more knowledge of, rather than something which seemed so out of control, and even today seemingly still out of control in terms of its prevalence of all these variants. And so I was quite confident that it was fairly acceptable risk. It also seemed that it would be the only option, like realistically in the world, that we would get a vaccine at some point. It was the safest way to have immunity. It just seems like a sensible thing to do. I also wanted to, you know, protect my wife, protect my family. The only reason why I couldn't sign my wife up was that she was breastfeeding, and that was one of the criteria. You couldn't have that. Otherwise I would have, you know, definitely wanted her to sign up as well. And she
what were the criteria? What were the criteria? What made you eligible?
it was they were looking for young people, because they wanted to, the first phase, just to have a bit more confidence. I don't think it was, I mean, I can't remember the criteria exactly, but it was something where, you know, a certain age range, and then they wanted to then, you know, you're not, it's a very standard clinical trial sort of stuff. People not pregnant or breastfeeding, those kind of things. And that's where I excluded my wife. But then for me, I didn't have any sort of pre-existing health conditions or anything. It was quite boring. And so then, yeah, they mentioned also that there's a risk of it being, you generate a hyper response basically to the disease. I mean, it's kind of, it was a bit concerned, because there was the big thing that everyone was having was, it sort of feels like the vocabulary is now lost, but it was the cytokine storm was the thing that was all everyone's talking about, trying to make sense of why the body response was so huge against the COVID. And so I guess that was one of the main risks, is that if you did get COVID, then would the vaccine actually make it worse? And then seemingly did not happen in the mice, and then also in then subsequent in the monkeys. And I found out only really later that they only got the word of that, the go ahead of that, those studies in the monkeys that morning, like just before, like hours before they injected me. So it's like there was no wiggle room in terms of time. There was no like, oh, we'll just come back, you know, have some coffee and come back later or something. Or come back next tomorrow or something. It was definitely trying to shave off as much time as possible, which is quite admirable and quite amazing. So
talk me through, having got to that, talk me through showing up for that first injection. Because, I mean, you were one of the first two, the only two who were done on that first day.
Yeah, so when I got a, I think I had like, they had a screening thing where you went in beforehand. They had people go in, and I found it very strange because I wasn't wearing a mask or anything, because I didn't have access to masks at the time. But we went in and everyone got screening and sort of health checks and everything. And they wanted to make sure that everyone was healthy beforehand. And so I, you know, before, if you were into the trial. And so they tell you all these potential risks. The main thing was that sort of, you know, over immune response, I think. So signing up for the trial, another thing I wouldn't mind mentioning is that at the stage, there was no possibility of even getting tested unless you're in hospital. I'm not a healthcare worker, and I wouldn't have been tested. So I almost, another, you know, slightly pragmatic response was like, well, at least I'll be tested, and at least they'll care about me in terms of keep an eye on me, and for health reasons, because they have an interest in actually keep an eye on me. So it was almost this pragmatic sort of thing of like, well, the situation in the UK is that, well, if I'm in the trial, at least they'll test me. And it was,
and terrible. You have a 50% chance of being vaccinated against the disease.
Yeah, that was seemed like a good sort of bet, but even just the testing bit, I thought was attractive. Just honestly, I thought that was, because that was, it was just such like a panic in terms of not being able to know if you were infected or not. And just the fear of then infecting someone else and feeling a bit responsible for that. I think I've always felt that, that responsibility. So before I went to the actual day, so there was that screening, and then there was, I received a phone call from the coordinator, so the clinical trial coordinator, and he asked me, like, as you said, how they wanted healthcare workers. So he asked me, you know, they can see that I've got some, you know, a postdoc, and I've got some experience and know how to communicate or knowledge of what the trial is and about. And he just wanted to check that I would feel comfortable, because there might be, he's always said in passing, there might be some, just be aware, there might be some media attention and they might ask you some questions. And in my mind, I'm framing it being, when he's calling me, I'm like thinking, they're going to have like, it's going to be just like a passing shot. There's like 20 people there or something, and I'll just be one of those people. And just by, they might ask me a question saying, how are you feeling? I'm like, I'm okay or something. I didn't really actually have much of a concept, and they didn't really tell me at all that they didn't tell me at that stage, I'll be one of the first two. And so when I did turn up that day, I realized that.
Let's just get the date again. Is that, it must be embedded in your memory because it's not completely embedded in your memory.
Honestly, I don't actually remember it.
It's somewhere, something like the 23rd of April, but I'm not absolutely sure. It was around then.
It's around then. It was one of those days. And whichever day it was. And so I remember when I was like signing up for it, I was realizing, because, you know, everyone's looking at the news and trying to be aware of it, and there's a lot of, you know, awareness of what the trial and stuff. And I remember, I can't remember exactly what point it was, either just before I arrived, I realized that I was like, I might have just looked at the clinical trial protocol, because they have to publish the protocol. Every update to the protocol, they have, if you're a participant, they keep giving you updates, just very small minor things, and they highlight them and things. It was always constantly being updated, little bits here and there. But I had a look at it, and it said that there would be two participants, and then they'll then do the subsequent, I think, six or something, after a couple of days. And so I realized that if I was going to be potentially the first that day, as he called up and told me, it then dawned on me going, oh, I actually might be one of the first two. So nobody actually told me exactly I'll be the first two, but except there was obviously the protocol, but they didn't actually specify that was going to be the case. And so then when I arrived and I'm the only one in the waiting room, just sitting there, just very curious about it. And you know, something that they're probably now so bored about doing and stuff in terms of having people churn for the participants and stuff. I was, the only one. And it was very, wide realization that I might be, the first or whichever.
And where was the location?
The location was just down the road from my work, actually. So I it was just at it's a pretty nothingy looking building, if you're honest, outside on the outskirts of the Churchill Hospital.
The Center for Clinical Vaccinology and Tropical Medicine.
Most of the buildings, the Churchill Hospital, mine included, they all look like low rise houses and things. They don't look like anything special. And so I get there and, you know, they check me on the list and stuff. And I see that there's only two names, there's a security guard, because they had obviously had security and stuff. I think they also had security just to make sure there was no other cameras except for the BBC, because they had the exclusive rights, turns out. So I waited and then I went in, and because I've never actually, because we never, myself and Eliza never actually crossed paths at all, the other participant and the first two participants. In fact, I don't think we've actually never seen each other in real life. We're never in the same place at the same time, maybe different rooms or something, but never actually in person. It came dawn to me, and I messaged my brother to saying, oh, by the way, I think I might be the first. And because he's living, he was at the time another Australian living in London. And I think he made a comment of saying, like, if Priya Patel's there, just make sure to point that you're Australian, like pointed out or something. So I find it quite fascinating when I reflect back on it that they chose one, a German and an Australian as their first participants for something that could be quite jingoistically a very homegrown British sort of vaccine. I don't know if that was a deliberate choice or not, but they wanted to have, because I was vibing from subsequent interviews, even one that was in the Corona cast of the BBC. He was saying that it was that COVID's bigger than Brexit. And I think that sort of was trying to frame it as being a global problem and a global thing. And I think that's definitely the sort of framework, at least they were portraying, is that this isn't a jingoistically British thing, but rather as a global problem, a global solution. And you can see that with the COVAX approach and the cost.
That vaccine. Was an Andy Pollard quote, wasn't it? The bigger than Brexit thing.
Yeah.
I've just listened to it this morning. So
yes. Well, yeah, that was that. Yeah, that was it. Yeah. So that was it. So anyway. So that I was waiting in the waiting room. Then I got in, and then there's Fergus Walsh and the cameraman, and they got in, and then they tell what's going to happen, that I'm going to have an injection, and they're going to ask me some questions straight afterwards. So it's quite a weird experience, knowing that I would be having an injection on camera, and then immediately had a microphone strictly in my face straight afterwards to say my word, as if it's like a Neil Armstrong situation. Just like, what is this word that I was saying? What are these statements afterwards? I do remember that, you know, because we weren't actually the first to get a COVID vaccine in the world. I remember that Moderna one was the first in the US. It's only days or something. It was a week before. It wasn't very long. So I remember the images and stuff. And I remember, like, they're going to have an image and they're going to keep using the image. I better have a cheerful shirt. So that's the sort of thought I had before I came. I'll make sure I have a nice cheerful, like, shirt. And so that's a short sleeve shirt. So I didn't have, you know, just roll it up and everything. Those are the sort of weird thoughts you have on the way to something that's potentially quite a big event. They asked me questions. It's a bit of a blur about it, but I remember that something I wanted to actually convey was that just because I'm sort of, you know, was aware of the situation and the apprehension about things, I myself as a Christian, I was quite conscious of the fact that what this action was actually, in many ways, a step of faith. And so I mentioned that as a way of saying, you know, I've got faith in the scientists and things, and mentioning that this is kind of a, because I kind of as a faith response would be something that you are knows to be true and then you do it. But it's not something you know for certain. Like, it's not something you know for certain. Just like the vaccine, you didn't know for certain that it was to be the case, that it'll be working or that it'll be safe and things. But you sort of walk in faith. You go, that's an active thing of going, using intellect, knowing that something that you believe to be true. And I thought that would be, I just in my mind thinking that, you know, maybe that might sort of cut against some sort of apprehension that people might be having. You know, that it's okay to sort of, I don't know, it was just something that I had in my mind, at least, because there can be, there's a lot of nervousness of the vaccine and a lot of, in faith groups and things about this, but I saw it as being, you know, how I express my faith with my science and things, is that that's how I would be approaching it, is that it's an intellectual trust. And also trust in the work of all the scientists, all the boring work they've done beforehand to get this point. There is emotion when it comes to the vaccine. It's always not as simple. There's always complicated motivations behind getting it and stuff. But I was wanting to sort of see it as being like, you sort of have to make a decision in your mind that this is a good decision and go for it, because there are emotions of it, you know. I remember when they just injected the vaccine in me, I was just thinking, that's a big syringe. That's a lot of liquid. Those are the kind of thoughts that go in your mind a bit.
And who else was present in the room apart from the BBC team?
But the
kind of leaders of the vaccine team, people like Andy Pollard.
No, they weren't there. I sensed that they were in the corridor. I sensed that they were in the corridor, and I don't know if it was fully blinded or not. I don't know to them. I don't know the situation, how much they knew, if it was double blinded or not, but I sensed that they were aware, but not being in the room, because, you know, they might, who knows what the effect was. Anyone getting the vaccine, you sort of have to hang around for a little bit. Because I'm the first, I have to hang around for a bit longer.
How long roughly were you there?
I think it was at least there for about half an hour or something afterwards. I can't remember, an hour or something. But they took bloods either just before or afterwards. I can't remember exactly. And then, you know, days later, you get a lot of bloods and so many little tubes of blood taken out over the time. So that's what... that's what kind of happened. And then
carry on as you were leaving.
Yeah. As I was leaving, I it's sort of a strange thing to be leaving the building. I was sort of just like heading home going, something big happened. And this feels strange, that this feels like, you know, the weight of the world on my shoulder kind of thing. And then I also recognized that there was an ambulance just parked right outside. And only later, I was just like thinking about it as I was cycling home, just going, maybe that was there just in case for us. Like, it was just like, you know, a private ambulance, just in case sort of situation. They probably had to have some sort of protocol thing just in case they had an anaphylactic shock or whatever. But it was just like, it's a dawn to me after, going, oh, that's potentially a risk. Which, you know, I get a call the other day, I can't remember, it was the day after or something, but they called me up saying, by the way, you might be aware of, I'm not sure you are, that there is a hoax that one of the other participant has died. I assure you that it hasn't.
Yeah.
As they called me up about that. But before that happened,
I was going to ask whether you'd actually seen the report that she died,
The first I heard was from the study, which was, you know, props to them, yeah, in terms of being able to preempt that. I can't remember exactly, because it's all a bit of a vague blur, because I did a whole bunch of a flurry of media interviews, because obviously they had the Fergus Walsh, the BBC footage that went out. Then they, a reporter, Australian reporter based in London, recognized the accent, then went in to hunt me down to sort of have an interview. And then I had an interview on Skype with him, and then that footage then seemingly got sort of sold on to a whole bunch of other shows in Australia in particular. And so then people in Australia then knew about me. And that was a bit of a weird, surreal experience having all that. Bit weird to sort of, you know, supposedly be all these shows without actually seeing, like, you know, being on the show, because then they'll have like fake people then ask you questions, the same question that the reporters have. And then I found the whole experience sort of slightly strange, because I felt quite removed from it, because I didn't have a TV license at the time. I still don't have a TV. So I never actually saw the footage or anything like that, except for just people literally, you know, videotaping on their phone or something, or a few YouTube clips or something. But it was interesting then to see how whatever stock footage from the BBC got then transformed, and sort of whatever they had their own cut through all the, you know, India and everywhere, and how much that, you know, spread for the world. And it was kind of a nice sort of opportunity to have this sort of a sense of hope of the, you know, the potential end to the coronavirus, or some sort of hope of a way of approaching it. So it's kind of a, it was nice to have that sort of, like, you know, after some, you know, crumminess of a, you know, really only a few months or whatever of it, to actually have that as an option, that this might be a way out. And I think one thing that sort of dawned on me, particularly when I had these interviews, is that it's something that a lot of reporters, they kind of were trying to angling for. They kind of, you know, I'm not the scientist of the trial. I'm not the person. One reporter in Australia kept on criticizing the vaccine and getting me to defend it. And it was not really appropriate. It's not my vaccine. But I sort of feel like I had to sort of defend it. It's very strange. I didn't like that guy. It's very critical. Australia was its own bubble away from it all, it seemed at the time. But they kind of, because I was sort of the human interest story of it, they kind of want to push you in to be like some sort of hero. And I remember sort of like pondering about it and sort of contemplating on it, realizing that, especially I saw at least one other early participant, not Eliza or someone else, giving interviews and stuff. And that what they would emphasize is, yeah, there's a real risk. They told us that if there's this, you know, the vaccine, if you get it, there's a whole risk that if I get it and then I get the COVID, then it'll be making it even worse and stuff, and really building it up. And also talking about their symptoms of the vaccine and stuff. And I just thought it's really inappropriate to talk about that, because it's an open trial. I'm blinded. I don't want to say what I have, et cetera, and I don't know. And I also realized the most important thing is that if you make it look like a heroic thing, it makes it immediately scary. You can't be heroic without being something scary. When in reality, I just wanted to emphasize it should be a pretty boring thing, just like we have with our vaccines, our normal flu shots or whatever. It's a fairly boring occurrence, like it should be. It shouldn't be any scary thing at all. And I was trying to be very emphasizing that, just to be like, no, you know, not to be like false humility. I saw the danger of that. It's very tempting to go to toot your own horn, but it's actually dangerous and actually counterproductive to actually think about the vaccine as a dangerous thing to be sort of, to be suck up and do it. And I remember that earlier on, people were very worried about it. And to be honest, I had less knowledge about the vaccine than anyone at the time, obviously, because it was the first one. But I'm more impressed by, like, you know, a lot of friends in Australia who, you know, about my age, who, as a result of Australia bungling up their COVID order, their vaccine orders and stuff, had a lot of AstraZeneca, but not any of the Pfizers and things. And so young people were going to be the end of the list, because a whole bunch of older people were actually hesitant, and they're actually at no risk really, but they were very hesitant. And so then it was sort of delaying the vaccine rollout, but a lot of young people, the government was like, well, talk to your GP if you're young, and then you can make a decision yourself. And so a lot of my friends did that, and they knew all the risks, potential risks, but they did it because they wanted to protect their, you know, their wife who was pregnant. They wanted to do all these things, and they, you know, in many ways, I know that they were influenced by the fact that I did it. They sort of had that sort of connection where they knew that because I went ahead and did it, that there's something to it or something, or, you know, that concept of it was okay. And I was quite amazed by the sheer sort of willingness of a lot of Australians to do that, even when they had very low numbers of COVID. It was sort of at the point where they were like, oh, we might get away with it not having any COVID, and therefore we shouldn't give vaccines because there's that tiny risk. But the assumption that there wasn't any COVID, as if it was not going to be inevitable anyway. So that was my sort of guiding philosophy in my mind, is to try to not make it a scary thing, to point towards the very boring work of science in terms of the careful work. It's just everything is just sped up given the resources. And it's quite an exciting sort of opportunity to see sort of science in action when you're given the resources, a huge amount of resources, and also really cool to see other academic teams working together when at times in academia we're sort of, we're colleagues but pseudo-competitors with your fellow colleagues. And just to see that, like, you know, the advancement of, like, of something which honestly was quite peripheral. And at times the vaccine sort of group, the Jenner and stuff, I was always aware of it, but in many ways it was kind of a bit of a, it was kind of a bit of a peripheral aspect of, like, research at university. It wasn't that central. It was not that sort of valued. And in fact, those, all those people who are now have permanent jobs and professorships and chair and things would have been just keep, you know, having to fight for their own jobs each, you know, every few years of, you know, getting their own fellowships and things. They would have had to keep fighting for their own survival and justification, just like all of us.
But this, I mean, brutally, all... they were doing great work, but a lot of it was on vaccines that would be deployed in developing countries rather than in the West. Things like Ebola and rabies and,
stuff that... a lot of companies wouldn't have thought to bother paying for, or the governments, or even, you know, something that is effectively aid work, effectively. Stuff that is really important. In fact, like, the vaccine for malaria might have way more impact than the COVID vaccine, but that doesn't get as much airtime. But that's actually a huge advancement. So it's not that they haven't been doing great work. It's just all of a sudden people paying attention to it. And they were given the resources, and they were able to give the time to focus on it. Mm. And
it wasn't your field, but it sounds to me as though you got very interested in the whole business of vaccine development, deployment, trials, as a result of your personal experience of having been a volunteer.
I was quite fascinated. I mean, like, the being in part of one of the first two participants, you got a bit of a firsthand look at how the trial was really, they were doing it as fast as they can, which means also they didn't have the electronic sort of checking system online sorted. We were given paper just to write it down ourselves and stuff. We were just, everything was kind of always, I wouldn't say last minute, but like pushing to the last minute. It was kind of, it was, everything was, you know, not done wrong or anything, but it's just going as fast as they possibly can. And so it was fascinating to see how something where, you know, honestly, it probably wasn't in their skill set. They're having to rapidly learn how to deal with a massive multinational vaccine rollout. But, you know, they are capable researchers that are able to adapt and change and take the moment. I'm sure it would have just been a case of just, I don't know, slight adrenaline just keeping them going. You just do this and you just keep doing it. I don't know at what point they actually sort of realized they could actually rest. And they certainly weren't doing too many sort of interviews and stuff. They're probably rejecting quite a few because they had to just get on with it. There's so much stuff to do. And if anything, I kind of felt like I was jumped in the deep end when it comes to this, all this media engagement and stuff. I wasn't given any training or any sort of instruction. I think I was asked, are you okay with some media around that first call? Then the subsequent fake death saying that, oh, if you have any issues, just let us know. If you're finding it a bit overwhelming, just don't respond to it.
Were people contacting you directly, or were you getting, what was the university press team feeding reporters to you?
I've never talked to the press team. It was all just directly to me. In fact, they found my university website. So via my university website and LinkedIn. I wasn't on Twitter at the time, but I realized I probably should be on Twitter. It's like, it was some of those things I just never really was all that involved with. But I signed up for Twitter because I thought, hey, maybe I might get some interest in my own research or something, you know, maybe I'll use that or as a way for people to find me. And so then they, I got direct messages from all these reporters around the world wanting to have interviews. They, one person even contacted my boss trying to find me, and he found that very befuddling. I did you know, Skype sort of interviews, or like, sometimes live interviews. I kept getting called up even months later because I was probably on the list of somebody that is related to the COVID vaccine. But I remember, like, later on, many months later, I was just, I wasn't keeping up to date with all of it. I didn't feel like I was an authority on this. I feel like a lot of people sort of jumped on the bandwagon of being somehow like a science authority on it. But I realized earlier on that I just, you know, I'm not an epidemiologist. I'm not qualified to sort of comment on many things. I can comment on the personal aspect of a fear or an apprehension of an unknown vaccine. That was my skill set. That was my expertise, I think. That sort of service I had, which I think at the time was important to not have this sort of brewing of fear of an unknown vaccine, to start at least early on to have that sort of a cheerful first, you know, experience or firsthand experience, have positive experiences with it, to be, you know, reminding people that COVID sucks and that we should be, you know, the vaccine is a perfectly sensible and reasonable thing to do, and not shouldn't be that scary. But I think it was quite a stressful time, all of that. I mean, I was already struggling with trying to work from home. Then having that, I just couldn't focus on any work for weeks. And my wife also found that really stressful. She found that really hard, that she felt like I should have just taken time off earlier on anyway, just to be sort of taking time out to help her with family and my son, and or just to be able to sort of cope emotionally, because, you know, we were already not coping before the vaccine happened. It was kind of like, as I said before, we were hoping for a holiday in Italy and in France and having this lovely time. And that was where we were at. We were sort of now just jumping into survival mode. And I think she was quite hurt by all these, like, I'll drop things to do this, these interviews and things. But in many ways, I was doing these, and I would sort of reflect on it afterwards. We were doing that, you know, there was an aspect of trying to do good in the world when things weren't going well, but also emotionally, I was trying to make sense of it. It's such a weird thing to be just plunged into celebrity, I wouldn't say celebrity, but, like, you know, a known status, where people will see you on the BBC each night, just in that the showreel and stuff, this the grab or whatever, or the COVID news or whatever. And so you were just like an awareness. And I think I just was, you know, trying to process it, because it's something that you would normally, if you're something really weird happened to you while you're, you know, you're in life normally, you would have a bit of a joke with all your colleagues and try to humanize and sort of relate to everybody. And you'd find the humor and the weirdness of it, sort of all normalize it and humanize it. But because everyone was stuck at home and separated from everybody, it was very bizarre. Like, I was talking in person with people, like reporters and other people. And I you know, that was my way of relating to this situation, but it was completely bizarre. And I still was trying to make sense of it, this being plunged into it. But also how, you know, you could actually, when push comes to shove, being able to actually communicate when put on the spot, the critical, the important things. And that's kind of the thing that you're taught in science, to always go back to the critical. What is the most important thing to convey when you're answering questions in seminars and stuff? You could waffle on for ages, but what is the critical thing, the critical answer? You want to give what is the important answers to things, that is the most helpful. And I think it made me, really realize the importance of clear communication of science, that, you can actually have I had the experience of enjoying the sort of the fruits of effectively years and years of work beforehand to sort of communicate the brilliance of all those researchers before me. It was a privilege to be able to talk about it all. It was quite interesting to see that end aspect of the media, to talk to, there's the documentary, which I don't think I've actually seen yet because I don't have a license. of the vaccine by Fergus Walsh. It was a good way to sort of process something that happened that was very bizarre, sort of a slightly bizarre experience. Because I think everyone had a different lockdown experience, everyone had a different COVID experience, and I had a very strange one, slightly unique.
How long did the follow-up go on? How long were you having to go back and give blood samples?
It's a bit of a blur, but it's something like, you know, it would be the first, it'd be like 48 hours, then a week, then 2 weeks, then a month, then it'll be like 3 months, then it'll be 6 months, then it'll be a year. And then they would, then they signed us up to get another vaccine. And I remember progressively that the, as the trial went on, my weirdness became less and less. Like I was just another person, just another participant. It's only when I got the second vaccine, which would turn out to be my first, because I was actually got the placebo originally, was that I, you know, was able to chat with one of them. It was a very, the nurse there, just that was a very weird experience. So yes, it was, yeah, it was that sort of certainty when I first actually got the vaccine that I knew I was going to get the actual vaccine, or at least the second, or just knowing for certain I was going to get something. And I felt like it.
So when, let's just clarify that. So you didn't, obviously when you got the vaccine, you didn't know whether you'd got the vaccine or that it's not actually a placebo, is it? It's a meningitis vaccine. So it's another, yeah. It is a real vaccine that might make your arm sore.
It did make my arm sore, but not that bad, yeah.
but not the COVID vaccine. But as far as I recall, when the vaccines were finally licensed in end of December, the participants were all asked if they, yeah, I mean, if they were eligible. I suppose they were, if you were that young, you wouldn't have been eligible in the first tranche of vaccination. Is that correct?
Yes,
I mean, the question, my question is really, when was it unblinded? When did you discover that you'd actually had the meningitis vaccine and not the COVID vaccine?
It was unblinded. Not straight after I got the second, which is actually the first.
So you were given another vaccination before you even knew what the first one had been?
Yeah.
And was that also, did you know that was a vaccine when you got it?
I knew it was the vaccine when I got it.
Okay, right, yeah.
And this was around the time when you made, there was suspicions of the clotting and everything was potentially happening.
But the rollout had begun by that time as well, presumably.
It started to. It started to. And I remember just like it wasn't that long after I got it that my wife actually got it, because we were sort of pushing it. I remember it was just the actual rollout, because my wife wasn't, she was on vulnerable list, but it was a very weird thing where she wasn't on the sort of technical, like proper NHS list. And so she wasn't on the normal rollout of the NHS. So we sort of had to hunt for the vaccine. And so we found that there was the mosques in Oxford had a whole bunch of drop-in centers. And when she went there, it was like, no one was there. And she was running a bit late, but she was the first one there. It was really depressing how much there was just not much knowledge of where these vaccines opportunities are. It was kind of a sense of relief when my wife got it, more so than when I got it, much more. In fact, she's got more vaccines than me because she's got she got the Pfizer than the bivalent. I according to my NHS record, it was all very confusing. NHS record had. I only got two second vaccines. I never got a first, technically, because they blinded it. It was all weird how it was entered. I have two, and then I had my Pfizer. I say that kind of because I kind of lost my record, which is actually kind of a bit funny, actually. I got a letter in the mail saying that, why haven't you gotten a vaccine yet? Because what happens is that my NHS number was stolen / taken by someone else.
Oh, no.
Something that supposedly never happens, but actually does happen. And then I had to fight to get that back. And then that means that the person who probably has never got the vaccine now looks like they were the first participant and have all my vaccine records. So I don't actually have a vaccine record anymore. I could pretend that I don't and then get another three. which, you know, health records are a funny thing. Just the irony of all these things happening, these things are very special, weird things happening to me. I got this sort of the second vaccine, and then later on found out that I actually had placebos. Then I was invited to go back I don't know what it was, 2-3 months later to get the second vaccine. Yeah. So yes, that was the, and then I was monitored for about a year or two on a long-term study. So every so often go back, and I'm now technically off everything. So I've done their sort of long-term monitoring of everything. And so I'm no longer part of the trial anymore, which was found a bit weird when it was just finally over, just a bit of a weird sort of chapter of my life just finished. And then that's gone. And you know, it's strange to imagine something that didn't happen, wasn't around or available to anyone at one point, but now it's become so part of life and so forgotten. Also the impact and the fear of it at the beginning was of the vaccine is just all dwindled away. And you know, I still am amazed that like the gamble that it actually did work, it did pay off. I mean, it could have easily not have worked at all. And just amazed at like the hilarity of what a real reflection of science is and the real story. He couldn't hide it, that the confusion of the dosing, you know, the fact that they thought it was twice as concentrated, so they get diluted in half accidentally. Yeah. It wasn't actually diluted in half, and then they thought that the half was actually better, but then it turned out it was the delay because of the confusion. That was actually the good thing. I just found that's just fascinating and just such an honest reflection of the science, because normally whenever you do scientific papers or anything, you publish things, you can never hide. You always hide everything. You always hide the truth in terms of what the order of all the sequences, the figures and everything and the story and stuff, but you couldn't hide this. You can't hide such a big public event and public sort of study that they had to be honest. So you could actually trust them because they didn't hide anything. They couldn't hide anything. They were very honest and transparent about the whole process. And I think it's such a nice reflection of making use of inadverted discoveries, that I think is that sort of has been a fantastic opportunity to learn more about the immune system, learn more about vaccines that you would never be able to do in any sort of trial, except for that accident of that delay. Mm. Mm. We may have still gone down that path of always doing it 1 month apart, etc. Instead of the 3 month sort of booster, which is just a fascinating sort of byproduct, a long-term byproduct of that. And it's quite interesting to find out about the, now we're knowing more about the clotting, about the reasons behind that. It's just you would never be able to see that in the trial because it's such a fluke of an event where your immune system responds to the structure of the virus itself and just the coincidence of it. It's just, you wouldn't be able to do it. So I still think that, I still believe what they did was correct, that there's nothing that they could have done to prevent that. And I still think it's a good vaccine.
It's a very, very low risk. I mean, it's measurable risk, but it's very low, isn't it, compared with the number of people who've had the vaccine.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely agree. And the amount of clotting you get from just COVID itself is much, much greater.
Much, much greater.
And it was only in Australia, which was able to achieve zero COVID at the time, they were actually afraid of the vaccine because it was much greater risk than nothing. But without realizing that, you know, trying to impress upon family and friends in Australia that, like, you know, the way COVID rolls and stuff, you get the vaccine, it doesn't actually kick in for like 3 weeks at least. You don't know what the whole world can change in 3 weeks, as we found out. These things can happen so quickly. It's with these vaccines, you sort of have to always think ahead in that respect. Always sort of anticipating that kind of how the world is going to change. You can't know. It was a strange privilege to sort of see sort of such a momentous sort of translation of science, and this huge impact in the world for something which in many ways is sort of, as scientists, you know, plugging away in the dark and feeling a relatively obscurity. You might be famous in your field, but you're relatively obscure. And just sort of be plucked into sort of the spotlight, these researchers, where, like, in many ways, you know, it could have just been any other researcher. It could have been so many other people. That's the brilliant thing about places like Oxford. There's so many brilliant people not given the sort of the limelight. If we had all this huge attention, they would be also seen to be great. It's not to diminish them, it's actually to elevate all the other researchers. The fact that their whole career has been out of the spotlight, and then all of a sudden they're having to navigate that sort of that realm of having to be some sort of, they're having to navigate politics of, like, you know, having to be careful of how they might be seen to be promoting certain aspects, especially when it gets political with lockdowns, with other things, and the how that became politicized, and then having to be very careful about it. It's like, and then having to also not have to jeopardize their own research program and their own vaccine. And it's hard. It's like something that you're not really experienced about navigating as a scientist, but realizing that, you know, yeah, it's a strange opportunity. Mm. And I think it's amazing that they've been able to do with it. But I think.
So for yourself, like, I mean, you've used the word strange and weird a lot. Knowing what you know now, would you do it again?
For me, for the signing up for vaccine, if there was another COVID 23, I mean, you could argue that was the variance, but if there was some sort of like a outbreak and stuff, yeah, I probably would. I think we knew enough that it was bad, and we knew enough that a vaccine was a good idea. And I would sign up for it again for something like that. I mean, it depends on weighing up them. I mean, we have so much more advanced vaccine technologies now. We have mRNA vaccines, we have ChAdOx, we have all these other vaccine technologies that we have so many options. I think that there is so much opportunity to scale up more now, and there's more ability to now know what is important to be more flexible, that I think I would jump on it if it was an opportunity to sort of protect my family and protect myself. I don't think you do this in isolation, these decisions. You always do it in weighing up with indecision where people who are impacted, like including your wife and your son and your family and things. You don't do these things willy-nilly, but I think it is, I would still have the same response. And I think, and that's because it was an intellectually safe decision based upon the known risks, weighing up these things, putting my emotions aside. You know, there's the emotions of the moment of what happens and everything, emotions beforehand. But I mean, it wasn't terribly much of a gut decision about being afraid of it. I would be more afraid these days because there is so much more apprehension about being controlled by lockdowns and things, that, you know, the fact that things are spreading so much that at times I fear if we are more vulnerable than we are ever been, that there is always this familiarity that as if it would be like, oh, it'll just be like COVID and we'll be fine at some point in the future. They'll get the vaccines, it'll all be fine. But yes, I certainly would. I don't regret the decision at all. And I think, you know, it could have been anyone being the one of the first to get vaccinated. It's just a bit of a roll of the dice. I'm sure I know that they wanted to have some people with medical experience, and they got two postdocs, people who were able to, you know, be able to communicate the science, I think, for that service. I think, you know, in future, I think they would have, it would have been better. And I think Oxford would be better to equip those first participants to be able to sort of communicate and have a more cohesive messaging. I just decided my messaging, my sort of tact, but that was my decision. But I know full well that I had the dangerous opportunity to create fear, first just about being a hero in the most mild sense, but then I could have just steamrolled the whole thing. It's such a vulnerable thing. I think it's as strange as an early participant, sort of the opportunity and danger you have to actually sow those seeds of fear. And I think in future, if there was one, that they should equip and sort of prepare those participants and support them with that. I think understandable. They wouldn't have been thought of, like, they wouldn't have anticipated to have a death rumor. It's just not their thought. All they were worrying about was trying to get anticipated this, the death rumor. you know, the what's it called?
The rumor of the death. Yes, yes.
Yeah. Sorry. I mean, like, they're going through all of the checks and balances, talking to NICE or whatever it is, the sort of, you know, the health security agency or whatever it was at the time. And then their whole world is trying to make sure they get over the line to inject into someone, and then the all this marketing sort of stuff, they realize they needed to help, they got the BBC and stuff, but then the whole like disinformation stuff, I don't think it was really anticipated. I mean, it wasn't there on their radar. It was like, who could possibly imagine that anyone would be wanting to poo-poo the sort of seemingly positively neutral thing of a vaccine? It seemed to be such a pure thing. Like, why would anyone want to create it? But I think you just
indeed,
seen...
indeed make a claim that could be so easily disproved in minutes.
I know. And I was so, you know, I was thinking at the time to be that this would be a great, this, I mean, this is going to be like such a death knell to all these anti-vaxxers. You know, the fact that like this now, like, we don't have huge measles outbreaks. We don't have these huge, like, you know, diseases in the past and stuff. And, you know, like, I can understand complacency that can creep in, but like, you know, it's pressing with COVID. But yeah, I was quite naive how to see how much anti-vaxxers would dig their heels in. And actually use as an opportunity, particularly when it comes to the distrust of government, distrust of people, authority, and distrust of authority figures. And I feel like that was such a, I didn't anticipate how much that would make cause people to be really promoting that anti-vax. I mean, fortunately, I never got any flack from anti-vaxxers. I mean, the only thing I ever really received was like, what's it called? Like, you know, a friend of my mum on Facebook going, oh, that seems like a silly thing to do about me. My mum would defend me or something like that on that. But otherwise, like, I've never received any sort of flack about from anti-vaxxers. I mean, I know plenty of people who've chosen not to get the vaccine, who are resistant, and they have their reasons why they don't want to give it. I disagree. But, you know, we could be friends. We're friends. It's not, doesn't affect us. These people could be perfectly reasonable, but there are just a certain subset of people who was just so vile and so fear. And I feel so sad for those people who on their deathbed were just even glad that they didn't get the vaccine. Just glad that they held out and they went to the end not getting it. And just that sad sort of desperate sort of like, you know, putting their heels in the ground. It's so sad. And I don't think you can ever really fully counter that. But what you can counter is the people who are a bit, you know, unsure, a bit apprehensive. It's a needle, you know. People don't like needles, you know. But just that sort of weighing up of things and just people being aware that this is a good thing, it's a useful thing, and not to be scared of it. Mm-hmm. I think the vast majority of people are like that. That was my experience with people in Australia. I mean, there was an anti-vax people, but they were kind of very minor, slightly mocked. They weren't very influential. And most people would get around, you know, got up and did it. And there was a very cohesive approach to it. I feel like there was a lot of missed opportunities of having everyone sort of, the vaccine rollout wasn't as effective as they could have been in the UK. And I think it's a bit of a shame. And I think that's sort of sad mixed messaging and stuff of it. And I think that's where I think there was a sort of, I feel at times when, you know, being exposed as almost the media bubbles of Australia and the UK, they're not exactly the same. And they're and these different worlds of perspectives. And you know, when they had zero COVID in Australia, there was just COVID just did not exist at all. And just they're completely, it's almost a bit weird about, you know, the need for a vaccine. We just relax and we can just take our time. But I remember when there was that rollout and everyone did sort of sign up for it. There was a different attitude, I think, in terms of how to summarize it. There was an attitude of collective freedom through the vaccine, that there was freedom through collective action. Whereas I felt at times the British approach was almost like there is individual freedom with the vaccine. And there wasn't that sort of collective act freedom. There was almost this approach of freedom for not lockdown and things, when there could have been collective freedom through vaccines and masks and things. There could have been such a different sort of slight attitude. And I feel like You know, I'm going back to the beginning when I said I almost long for early lockdown. I enjoy that sort of sense of collective action where everyone was involved. I think it's hard for us to even imagine it, that the people would be clapping for nurses and stuff, the sort of the government would be jingoistically doing all that stuff. And we have this, how far we've come when it comes to strikes with the government's approach to the health workers. It's just, yeah, it has been fascinating to see how much it has changed and the society has changed. And I do long for those early days of lockdown, to be honest. There was a slight sort of hunkering down, almost like a Christmas attitude of hibernation and reflection. And
a clarity around what needed to be done, a sense that there was some direction coming from the centre. We should just kind of finish your story. When were you able to get back to your proper work? And was it difficult?
Well, I think it was quite a long time. I think I couldn't really get back into actually the lab just because of paperwork. There's a lot of paperwork when it comes to assuring that there will be this many people in the lab and this many spaces and stuff. And it was just such a headache just to be able to like organize that to make sure that there was social distancing. And it's so hard to like predict how long you'll be in the lab, your experiments and things, and like have time slots and stuff. It's very disruptive. And so you had to be very selective about the times you actually got in and what you would actually focus on. I was really scared. I was scared for many things. I did not want to get the COVID because I knew that if I got sick, I could get long COVID and then I wouldn't be able to work. And I was quite scared because I was on a tier two contract, which is, you know, a visa. If I didn't have work and my contract finished, I would be evicted. I was scared. What would that mean? I couldn't go back to Australia. The borders are shut, even to Australians. You couldn't go back. Would I be an illegal immigrant? Would that mean that my landlord would be therefore like in trouble if they rent it to me? The implications of this, I was feeling really scared and nervous. I put in a grant just before COVID, got amazing feedback. I got, you know, out of six, the external reviewers, I got six and five. I was thinking, wow, this is fantastic. I'm going to be great. This is going to be great. I can't comment on what was behind the scenes. I mean, whenever you submit a grant, you know, months later, you always see your own, you know, foibles and things. You always improve. So I'm not saying it was a perfect grant. But when it came to the committee, they have to weigh up how these projects would have a national and international impact. And normally they would be, funding bodies would be awarding things to eights, maybe eights and sevens, maybe usually eights, they, you know, out of 10. This is how they would be ranking things. But in this one, I've never ever seen it before, but there were like three projects that were 10. I've never seen it before. It can't have been anything else but a fast-tracked COVID research projects in this sort of MRC body. So when they announced all these new medical research projects, all these medical fundings for COVID research, the government would talk about how many millions there are. That millions didn't come from anywhere except for the existing research budgets. And so it's cannibalizing existing funding. So I didn't get that grant. That would have been a fantastic thing. It would have been given me assurance for a few years, set me up in terms of my career, being able to be a named postdoc on this grant. So it's effectively almost like my grant, and it would have been fantastic. And so I was then battling with the fact that I would then have only 6-8 months left of funding or something. I was going to have to get some stuff out on my existing contract. And so we had a backup grant that had a 1-year funding that was for one postdoc, my colleague. And then if it was then going to get extended, we needed to get certain results out. And that was going to be another 3 years on top of that. And that was through prostate cancer research. And so I had to just really get this results. I had to be in the lab whenever I could with that and to get the results quick as I could, knowing that I had to balance, I can't just hog all the slots in my lab. So balancing that, being able to get it, so feeling tense, and I had to put all my other projects aside because I had to focus those times in order to survive effectively, to get it, to have salary to stay where I am. And so it was kind of a scary time, just having to really, one, not get sick so I wouldn't be, I thought I'd be able to get the research done, and about a sort of cope. And so, yeah, it was quite a scary time to be threatened with homelessness, effectively threatened with the ability that you wouldn't be able to cope with your research, and the opportunities for funding were just few and far between. The fact that I got extended and we did get that, that was almost unheard of. Like, it was completely outside of the normal funding cycles, where basically all the site funding got stopped or extended. There was no new funds for scientists, and a lot of people would have had to be dropped out effectively. Maybe a lot of people got furloughed and extended. I don't think I was eligible for furlough because I was an immigrant and T2 visa. I don't think I was. So I had to keep working. And there was so there's no possibility of sort of extending it. So it was quite of a scary point. But fortunately, I was able to get that life raft of that funding to get to the next stage. But it was fairly tense. Like, it was a very uncertain time with that. And it's kind of those sort of the products of when there's, it's easy to see when people, for example, existing researchers, when they lose their jobs, they make a splash, right? But what you don't see when it comes to these absence of new funding rounds or new sort of the next step or the new early career research grants is you don't see what you can't see. You can't see what could have been, or the fact that there was no funding for new researchers. It was existing researchers that would be held out and existing. So there's a whole generation or this little cohort of researchers who had to sort of find ways to cope or may have missed out and dropped out. So there are actually probably a lot of, casualties of that funding cycle that will never be known, and very hard to see, because no scientist is going to be as bold as being, I missed out on this grant because of COVID, or, I didn't get funded because of COVID. It can't ever say for sure, because you can never be sure of any grant. But in terms of this, I feel as if I would have been affected because of, I know that that was prioritized and I can't escape that. I was able to get a grant. I'm fortunate in that respect. And now I've got some funding that I've lined up for a fellowship as well. So I'm sort of, I feel as if I'm kind of back on the right direction. But I was definitely was in the right direction before. I was definitely on a much better trajectory. I got a couple of early career awards, or these conferences that became virtual during 2020. So it was a weird sort of, but when you do those things, it's all because of the work in 2019. So it's not, it's sort of, I felt like I've lost maybe 1 or 2 years. I feel like I'm completely shifted in terms of my career, and I'm now getting up to speed with it, but it definitely has impacted. And in many ways, I don't think anyone in science for that sort of perilous sort of career has been unaffected. I think everyone's been affected. I think a lot of people are not honest about how much they are affected. There's a lot of bravado and things, but I think everyone has been affected, and everyone has a different story. And it has been, I think some people may have coped better. I had a young child at home, and that was hard. It's hard to have to focus on science when you have a young child at home. And that's hard. And so everyone has different stories and stuff. And I think there will be so much studies in terms of sociology and economics looking at researchers and the impact on scientists during COVID, and the disruption it had. As I flagged before, some were good, managed your time to pause and reflect and analyze. In many ways, it's healthy to do that, particularly when you at times you sort of feel the obligation to always get more and more data. But in many ways, that sort of career uncertainty, the funding uncertainty, was just exacerbated more and more. And the most sheer irony of where the whole world was banking on medical research to be the one getting themselves out of this whole mess, is this sort of world that is still more perilous than ever in terms of uncertainty. And so it's sort of, Yeah, it feels a bit conflicted at times when you see there's everyone can see the value of medical research, but they don't see that in order to get that vaccine, they needed to actually fund the medical research years before, the boring aspects. People, structural biologists, I think I heard once of that, the fact that they could actually create these vaccines because they actually knew how to design this spike protein, which is actually really hard to actually build and construct in terms of it, except some person knew after many, many trials and errors that you need to have certain prolines at the base region of it to want to express it. And that's the reason why we could have all those mRNA vaccines and all those things, because there's one person years ago, probably nobody really knows about, probably got no much not much cred, but that critical step meant that you could actually have these vaccines. I mean, there are many viruses we wouldn't be able to just click and play like this without that kind of knowledge. But it's those kind of boring steps that get overlooked, and I feel that I don't feel like we've learned our lesson in that respect, and I feel like we haven't learned our lesson of what we value in society, of medical research. We have valued personal freedom. I think that's definitely something that was very much emphasized, and I think that's something that we were longing for, as if it was what it was before. But I feel like what it was before with medical research is always perilous, and I feel like it's become more perilous in terms of the certainty of the career. And I feel like it just feels a bit sad because we have seen the sheer brilliance of it. So I think, in terms of the long-lasting legacy of it, I definitely see the effect of translational research, the value of it. But I don't want to overlook the importance of discovery research, because it's those discovery steps, the boring steps, the fact that mRNA was such a peripheral thing years ago that it's kind of the joke that I think I'm ever hearing about, is the fact if, how do you destroy mRNA? You just look at it and it dies. It's so flimsy. It's just the fact that they could define a delivery mechanism to actually get it into people's arms, and hence why they were so afraid of when they were giving the vaccines. You couldn't walk up stairs. You couldn't walk up and down a stair because that will destroy the whole thing. The fear of it. It's just there's yeah. That's how I perceive the science. I perceive the sort of story of it all. I'm conscious of the fact that there's the boring story behind the stuff that, and I know that I was at the sort of receiving end, the sort of a pivotal point that I, of the sort of human interest story. But I was very much conscious of that there's a lot more scientists, a lot of things going behind the scenes that wouldn't get the sort of the coverage and the sort of opportunity to express it. And at times I feel like, how do we as scientists convey that sort of importance to people, to the general public? Because they're the ones who vote, they're the ones who, promote science. And at times I'm still puzzled at times. Except I personally would just like to share the joy of discoveries, just share that joy. And I feel like I, as a, the vaccine participant, I was able to share that joy. And I think when people sharing that joy, they were seeing it as joy of freedom, but I was seeing the joy of discovery, the science, and seeing how that sort of those solutions. And, I think everyone sort of approached it differently, even that circumstance, that the particular time. I think my joy in that moment may have been different, what other people have seen of that. But I think that's something that I would always want, I think would be a good way to sort of have that sort of pride of these scientists. And I think that's definitely what they were trying to do with these royal honors and things with these researchers. And they're constantly trying to sort of make sure they have that sort of front and center of that opportunity to have that pride of that opportunity for scientists to do good and translation. But it is a hard story, because hard thing to do, because they're at the certain point of the story. There are other scientists before them, and they don't get the honors. It's interesting how, like, more peripheral from them, they get less decreasing honors and things. And it's sort of that they're all part of the story. And it's the same problem we have with Nobel Prizes. They only give it to the three people when it's like dozens of people working on the project. But we keep putting this like pedestal of these scientists as being on the pedestal, when really it's this huge pyramid of stories of individual researchers plugging away in the labs. That is like the reality of science. And And I find that, you know, even then we are tempted when we retell this story to overlook them, overlook those the boring steps, the technical steps that don't get as much coverage, but actually those researchers they don't necessarily have to have the final product to see the joy in their work. The individual steps are still a joy. There still is involvement. But it is exciting to see that when scientists are all put together and promoted and sort of given the resources to get on with their work, it's just exciting to see that. And it's been, I'm quite fascinated to see what will happen in the future if academic research becomes more almost corporate in that respect, that we have more of a team approach, moving away from these pedestal people, these sort of weird ego, not to say that those researchers are egotistical or anything. I'm just saying the structure is science is it places too much on the personality of one person or a person or the one as if they're the one group leader and stuff, when really it's team. That's why I love the fact that it was the vaccine team, the Oxford vaccine team. It was academics working together, and I always love collaborative research and being able to see working together as a team, because it's, you get to share the joys together and the lows, but you hopefully get to pick each other up. But it was great to see that collective team, and hopefully people were able to see that sort of the product when we give scientists resources and the ability to sort of feel comfortable to be able to not have to almost claw each other to get at these sort of positions when they're in a slightly competitive, but actually be working together in these clusters.
That's great. No, I think that's a really good place to finish.
I'm kind of like, sort of, I don't know if I was rambling there, but I feel like, you know, it does sort of make you, it has been a big moment in my life. And I mean, that I sort of reflected a lot on what I do, what I continue to do, how I go. I won't be the same researcher. Since I would always be slightly different, slightly motivated. I always have that sort of weird anecdote. It's always useful to bring up. But also it's a way of connecting with people. And I think that is something that scientists do find hard to connect with people. But this was a particular point where we all were connected and very clearly.
Very great. Very good. Great. I'm going to stop recording now.